Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on limited liability stories right after this. You know, when people call the law school, they sometimes ask me how they can learn more about the topics that I speak on over the air. Now, keep in mind that most of these topics that you hear on the radio, I teach in detail in one of my classes here at the law school. For example, when you hear me talking about the common law, it was Alfred the Great who codified the common law back in 872 AD into 49 principles or statutes, of which 22 are incorporated into our Constitution and Bill of Rights. Now, the common law was taken from the Mosaic law, and it was given to Moses at Mount Sinai and recorded in Exodus 19, verse 16, through Exodus 24, verse 8. And it includes negligence, insurance, and taxes, such as income tax, property tax, and social security taxes. Now, these IRS tax laws are a counterfeit of the tithing laws of Scripture, and they work a theft on everyone who participates in them. Now, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob gave us a better way of life than income tax and social security, and that's the basis of my tax and status school. We owe this income tax and social security tax, all right, but it's because we've contracted into it. Now, if you'd like to learn more about this tax and status issue, why don't you call or write for my free general law CD package. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website and you can download that free general law CD package right off of our website, georgegordon.org, and then go to the archives page. You can download it right there. All right, last time we were talking about the limited liability story by showing you how the law enforcement growth industry sells more and more crime by sending the chief of police into the city council, and he says crime grew 5% last year and I need 5% more money, 5% more police, and 5% more laws to combat it. And city council says that's pretty logical to me, so they give it to him. Now he's got 5 more policemen, 5 more laws, and he's got 5% more money, and he goes out and he sells 5% more crime. We're buying crime. That's what that boils down to. Now let's take a look at a real-life case of an actual criminal, an actual citizen who actually goes out, breaks the law, and the law enforcement growth industry deals with him, and let's see how much that costs us. Law and order costs money. I happened to be in the Ada County Jail one time, and a prisoner came through, and we'll call him Joe, and we'll call me the citizen, and I interviewed him, and this is the interview that I wrote down. Now, Joe is a college student, bright, extremely intelligent, and low on funds, and the following is a typical conversation between Joe and the other citizen. The citizen asked him, well, what happened to cause you to be put in jail? And Joe replied, well, I stole $350, he replies matter-of-factly. Citizen: so you are guilty of the crime, and you do, in fact, deserve to be punished. And Joe responds, yes. And he replies very matter-of-factly, yes. Citizen: well, tell me exactly what happened. And Joe says, okay, I was in the BSU auditorium, broke, and I didn't know how to make ends meet. And I saw this lady's open purse on a chair. It had money in it, so I took the purse. Now, apparently, someone saw me take the purse, and they called the police. They told the police who I was, and the police came to my apartment and arrested me. And that's all there was to it. Now, the law in Idaho is that any theft over $150 is grand larceny. It's a felony. I was convicted of grand larceny and sentenced to an indeterminate 5-year sentence in the state penitentiary. That means that I can spend anywhere from 18 months at the low end to a maximum of 5 years in the state prison. Citizen: well, did you plead guilty to that charge? Joe: no, I pled not guilty. My public defender advised me to plead not guilty and to take it to trial. Citizen: well, how long was the trial? Joe: 1.5 days. Citizen: well, how much time have you served so far? Joe: 11 months. Citizen: well, did the lady ever get her purse and her money back? Joe: no, I spent the money to pay my bills and I threw the purse away. Now, this is an actual true conversation, and it can be repeated in a variety of ways, hundreds of times, by judges, police, prosecutors, defense lawyers, and public defenders. And this shows how a real crime happens. There was a real criminal and a real victim. So let's see how much this crime actually cost the taxpayers in order to apprehend, try, convict, incarcerate, and then parole this man back into productive society. here's what the numbers are. Get your pen and paper out there, boys and girls, and let's take a look at what it actually costs you as the taxpayer for all this law and order that we all deserve. Well, it cost at least $2,000 to try, defend, and incarcerate Joe. We had to pay the judge, prosecutor, witnesses, jurors, and Joe's defense attorney. Remember, Joe was defended by the public defender, and he's paid for at public expense. Now, Joe is going to spend a minimum of 18 months in prison, and it costs $15,000 a year to store Joe in the prison. So the first bill to come in to the victim in this crime is $22,500, assuming Joe will be paroled for the remaining 3.5 years at $13.86 a day. His parole will cost another $27,771.50. Now, in addition, the lady didn't get her $350 back, making a grand total cost for Joe's crime $67,271.50. Now, who's going to pay that $67,271.50? Well, the victim and the rest of the community pay that. So, in the name of law and order, the victim of this theft is going to pay $67,000. But what about Joe? Well, Joe plays cards, he produces nothing, he consumes food, he needs shoes, clothes, and shelter, and in addition, the state provides employment for guards, police, and all of the others in the law enforcement growth industry. Now, multiply this example by the hundreds, and we can readily see billions of dollars wasted in the name of law and order. The lady, society in this case, who had her purse stolen, would have been $67,271.50 richer if she had not reported that theft of her purse and Joe had never gone to jail. The victim, in effect, sentenced herself to a fine by taxation of $52,271.50 for her demand for law and order. The victim is a loser because she lost both her purse and money, and then on top of that, she was taxed to support Joe and the law enforcement growth industry for the next 5 years. She would have been financially better off to have simply bought Joe an airplane ticket back to California and sent him away. Now, Joe is also a loser. The only winner in this entire game is the law enforcement growth industry. Now, just how Joe is the loser is a story in itself. You see, the law in Idaho declaring $150 as the amount for grand larceny was passed back in 1949. And because of inflation, in $1949, his crime should now be a misdemeanor. But Joe has been branded a felon for life. Now, Joe is a first-time loser. He's never been in trouble before. But because of this crime, he will never be able to put his mistake behind him. This will follow him for the rest of his life. He now has a prison record. And now he is in a school of crime, and he is learning from his mistakes in that crime school called prison, which is filled with his peers, filled with drug addicts and pickpockets and robbers and thieves. And when Joe comes out of prison, he will have a degree in crime. He will have spent 5 years, or in this case, perhaps as little as a year and a half, in crime school, learning crime from real criminals in real time. Society will reject Joe because of his mistake. So in order for Joe to make a living, he will have to resort to crime. What else can he do? The government won't hire him in any government employment because he's a convicted felon. The big industries will not hire him because he's a convicted felon. In fact, most businessmen, if they find that Joe is a convicted felon, won't hire him. Now, Joe is going to be released at some point in time, and he's going to have to go out and make a living. So if he can't make a living working for government, he can't make a living in any of the professions because he's a convicted felon, he can't make a living working for corporate America, then what's he going to do? He has to go to entrepreneurship. He's going to have to go out and sell drugs on the street or rob or do something that he's learned in prison because he isn't skilled to do anything else, and nobody else is going to give him a chance, are they? Now, crime pays because most crimes are never reported. Of the crimes that are reported, most of them are not solved. Joe will be caught once in a while, so he will be a regular customer of the law enforcement growth industry for the rest of his life. He will also be institutionalized and forced to live in an unnatural animal-like zoo environment and may become a homosexual, or at least be exposed to a homosexual environment that will have a negative effect upon his morals, his character, and any potential rehabilitation. Now, whether we like it or not, Joe is going to be out on the street again, and society then is faced with another problem. At some point in time, we will again have to deal with Joe. Now, for the past 40-plus years, we have been dealing with all of these Joes, and what we have been doing has not worked. So it's about time to admit that what we have been doing has failed, and we need to try something new, something innovative, something different. Now, whatever we do, It can't be any worse than what we're doing now, can it? Now, we know that there's a problem, but what do we do about this problem? And there's another fact to examine before the disclosure of a solution. Where did these prisons and dungeons as a form of punishment come from? The answer is actually lost in antiquity. But in the Bible, in the scripture, there are numerous accounts of individuals like Joseph, Daniel, Peter, and others being put in prison, being put in the dungeon. And like the pagan nations used prisons and dungeons to punish their criminals and political prisoners, we here in the United States are using these same pagan principles to punish our criminals by putting them into prisons and dungeons. Now, there was an exception in the scripture. It was found in the time of Moses. When the Israelites crossed the Jordan River, they had a different kind of law. It was called the common law. It's known as substantive law. It's based upon substance. It's based upon land, labor, and substance or property. Now, the common law, substantive law, and rights at law that our Constitution, a Bill of Rights guaranteed to each and every one of us, is based upon substance. The connection between the Ten Commandments, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights, and this thing called substantive law, is bound up in this axiom or maxim of law that if there is a remedy at law, equity cannot prevail. But conversely, if there is no remedy at law, then equity can prevail. Now, James Madison, who was the father of our Constitution, made reference to this when he said that the Constitution was tied to the principle that we assume every man will obey the Ten Commandments. Our common law came from England, but its roots are at Mount Sinai. Moses brought the law down from the mountain, and it is recorded in Exodus chapter 20. The next five chapters of Exodus contain the criminal codes. They're very short and precise. There were no prisons, there were no dungeons, and there were no political prisoners in Israel. Let me repeat that. Under the Mosaic law, there are no prisons, dungeons, or political prisoners. The Israelites borrowed the prison system from the Romans, Egyptians, and Babylonians. That's where we got it. We didn't get that from God. We got it from the pagan nations around us. Now, we have that system in use in America today, and indeed it's in use around the world. All of the nations of the world use this Babylonian, Egyptian, pagan system of incarceration. And it is unusually cruel to lock a man up like an animal. Now, we don't even do that in our zoos anymore. It used to be, when I was a kid, that you locked monkeys up in cages. You locked gorillas up in cages. And then you sold tickets so that you could come in and look at them, like the carnival sideshow or the circus. Now, because we're so enlightened, we took a look at that and we said, well, that is really cruel. So now in our zoos, they build, at great expense, by the way, a natural habitat for the gorillas, a natural habitat for the polar bears, a natural habitat. And then they walk around in their natural habitat, and they swim in pools, and they climb trees and do all those things that they would be doing if they were out in the jungle or up at the North Pole or wherever. Now, we don't do that for prisoners. We lock them up in cages. Human beings are locked up like we used to lock up animals. Now, we call this humane. We sentence people to life in prison. That's not quite true. And when you sentence somebody to life in prison without possibility of parole, that is a death sentence. He's not coming out of there until he dies. The method by which we're going to kill him is attrition in a cage. We are going to cage you up and let you die slowly by attrition over the next 40 or 50 years, sucker. Now, boys and girls, we don't even do that to rabid animals. I was out driving my car down the road one day, and I saw a deer who had jumped over a barbed wire fence, and his legs, one of his back legs, got caught between the two top strands. As he went over, he impaled himself on the barbed wire fence. He snared himself. He'd been there for a day or two. He'd been trying to get loose. His leg was all cut up. It was down to the bone. Obviously, the animal was in great pain, great suffering. So I went back to the car, and I got a hammer. I didn't have a gun or I shot him. I got a hammer. Then I came back and I hit that deer over the head and I beat it until its brains were coming out so that I could relieve the animal of his pain. There wasn't any hope that that animal could live or survive. He was too badly damaged from the barbed wire. Now, I suppose I could have looked at the animal as I drove by and said, well, that's life. That animal could have been hung up in that fence perhaps for a week until it finally died of starvation or probably died of thirst. I couldn't do that. I wouldn't do that to a dog. I wouldn't do that to a deer. I wouldn't do that to a rattlesnake. When a horse breaks its leg, we shoot it. put him out of his misery. Now, how you can sentence somebody to life in prison, which is in effect a death sentence, by being caged up, doesn't strike me as being kinder and gentler. If I was that guy, I'd prefer you just put me out of my misery, shoot me, and get it over with. No, we're not going to do that. Not here in America. It's not the American way. Now, the act of punishing a victim of a crime by taxing him to house, feed, and guard this wrongdoer is adding crime upon crime. Listen, you've got a victim over here, a lady. She's lost $350. But that's not satisfactory. The law enforcement industry says, here's what we're going to do. We're going to catch this thief, we're going to prosecute him, and we're going to make this victim who lost her purse pay another $52,000 to lock this guy up for 5 years. Really, lady, do you believe that losing $350 demands law and order so that you can pay $52,000? The lady says, well, I'm not going to pay the $52,000. So what the lady says is, I want law and order, and I want retribution, so I want all the rest of you taxpayers out there to pony up $350 each, and you help me lock him up for 5 years. Boys and girls, do we really want to spend $52,000 to punish a guy that stole $350? Do you want to hire guards, build a prison, feed this guy for 5 years because he stole $350? Now, I'm not suggesting that we should let this guy go and not punish him at all, but is that the way you want to do that? It's certainly not economical. And when we take a look at the recidivism that comes from these prisoners over here, it doesn't even serve its purpose for rehabilitation. 70% of these guys end up back in jail again. Some prisons, it's higher than that. So the idea that we're going to teach this guy a lesson, I think, is a fiction. So the act of punishing a victim of a crime by taxing that victim to house, feed, and guard the wrongdoer is just adding insult to injury. I would contend that we should stop punishing the citizens and stop the useless waste of the criminal's life and make the criminal pay the cost of his wrongdoer. Make the criminal pay, not the taxpayer. Let us stop the profit in the law enforcement growth industry, and let's use the manpower of the crime and the law enforcement growth industry to make our lives more fruitful, more beneficial. Let's examine Joe's case. Now, Joe stole $350 cash, but he also threw the woman's purse away. So the victim has suffered a further loss of time, pictures, credit cards. Now, let's set a value upon the crime. It's a common law crime. It involves the loss of life, liberty, and or property of somebody. The common law is designed to restore property and to remedy damages. So let's say Joe's crime is valued at $50,000, which is very excessive. I mean, the guy didn't cause $50,000 worth of damage. You know, but for the sake of our discussion, let's just presume that it was. It's a starting point. Joe gets 5 years or $50,000, whichever he prefers. However, Joe is poor, which was the reason for his theft. Now, we're going to enforce upon Joe the option of the prison, which no one likes because of the boredom, lack of purpose, and humiliation. Now, since Joe has an obligation, let's have Joe work that obligation off. Now, the forests of Idaho are a tinderbox of dry limbs, dead trees, snags, and brush, which, when ignited, burn hot on the ground. The fire then burns up the tree trunks, crowns, kills the trees, and destroys the forest. Let's take Joe out to Atlanta. Let's put him to work in a productive capacity, gathering up this dead and dry wood, burning it in small fires, and clearing up the forest floor. It costs less than concrete buildings. Joe is not dangerous, so let's teach Joe the dignity of work and of making restitution to the victim and the taxpayers for the cost of his crime. Convict labor is not a new idea. It's been used before. California has used a work camp program in the past. Now, the only problem is that it can be easily abused. The 13th Amendment is not violated by the use of convict labor. Joe will volunteer to go to the Atlanta-Idaho prison camp to work on forest projects, such as helping with forest fires, replanting trees, cutting diseased trees, and cutting firewood. Joe will be paid $5 an hour or by piece rate. The more he produces, the more he makes, earning his freedom sooner. Joe owes 10,000 hours at $5 an hour. If he works 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, for 3 years, he earns his freedom. There's no parole, no strings attached. Joe is a free man, and the victim receives her loss in tax credits or direct payments from sales resulting from Joe's labor of firewood or trees. Now, the unions and the law enforcement growth industry have resisted and will continue to resist any change, as they have done so in the past. However, the state is losing more with the present system. No one is hurt by setting convicts to work in our forests, and there are other public projects that unions and other workers are not or do not care to be engaged in that could be accomplished. Numerous prisoners have been interviewed and have stated that they would welcome an opportunity to have a chance to work off their sentences. So let's look at an ancient example of common law damage paid for the losses that have been suffered. In the scripture, we see this statement in Exodus 21, verse 22, where it says, "If men strive and hurt a woman with child, so that her fruit departs from her, and yet no mischief follow, he shall surely be punished, according as the woman's husband shall lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judge determines." Exodus 21, verse 22. So here's an example of common law damages from what we would call a crime today, and would want to imprison this man. Here's another example. "If a man shall deliver unto his neighbor money or stuff to keep, and it be stolen out of the man's house, if the thief be found, then let him pay double." Exodus 27, verse 7. Here again is an example where it's the thief who pays for the crime, not the citizens, not the victims. And the thief pays double. There are dozens of examples of the common law usage of crime and punishment in the scripture. You'll find them in Exodus chapter 21 through chapter 24. Now, there are no biblical examples of letting the victim suffer the loss of goods and then be taxed to support the thief in prison as an added punishment to the victim. This constitutes punishment of the victim, which is unjust because it causes a greater loss to the victim than to the thief. Now, if scriptural examples are repulsive to you, then let's leave God out of the equation altogether. Just ignore God and just rely upon your own self-interest, just your own common sense. Simple logic tells us that it is in the best interest of all to change our prison system approach to crime and punishment. As a victim, what would you prefer? Restitution for your loss or additional taxation to pay for the incarceration of the thief? Now, some years ago, a car was stolen, and when it was recovered by the police, they issued the owner a ticket for leaving the key in the ignition. In other words, for every crime that is committed, there may be another crime manufactured by the legislature. Maybe the legislature will pass a law making it a crime to leave your house unlocked. Then, when something is stolen from your house, you will be guilty of a crime for failing to secure your house. Why should the citizen even report the theft if he's going to be punished by the police? Oh, the insurance company needs the report. Remember, we need insurance, don't we? It's the insurance company that needs this police report so that the insurance company can pay. In this class of crime, the real party of interest is the insurance company. It is the insurance company that wants you to remove your keys from your car and lock your house. It's the insurance company that stands to lose profits from your lack of an act, and therefore they want you punished when you fail to perform. So you have auto insurance so that in case a thief steals your car, the insurance company will pay you. The insurance company wants a police report. The insurance company wants you to take your keys out of the car so that people won't steal your car. So it's the insurance company that goes to the legislature and says, "We need a law that if you leave your keys in your car and your car is stolen, we're going to punish you for leaving your keys in your car, for enticing a good kid to go bad." Now, such legislation is the using of the police power of the state to enforce private interests, decreasing claims and increasing profits of the insurance companies. It's a symbiotic relationship between government and the insurance industry for the purpose of making profit. Now, the traffic courts provide a further example of government protecting private interests. Who cares if a person speeds down the road, and especially if that person is in the only vehicle on the road? If we were home and asleep, do we really care how fast somebody's driving down the road? However, statistics tell us that speed kills, and if so, speed causes accidents, and accidents cause claims at the insurance claims window. Claims at the insurance claims window cause an increase in operating costs and therefore a decrease in profit. The reason that we want speed laws is to decrease the drain on the claims window of the insurance company. None of the rest of us are really concerned about how fast you drive, but the insurance company is. And you need to be regulated and controlled, remember, Bob, because you've got an insurance policy and you're a member of a regulated enterprise. The reason that you have to buckle your seatbelt is because if you don't and you're involved in an accident and you go through the windshield, it's going to cost a lot more money to patch you up. That means the claims window has to pay out more money, which means they have to raise rates, which is going to affect all of the premiums that all the rest of us pay. Remember, we practice from each according to his ability and to each according to his need under the 10-plank program. Under the common law program, everybody's responsible for his own actions. So if you go through your windshield because you didn't buckle your seatbelt, you're not going to collect any insurance anyway, and you've got to pay all of your own bills. After all, you're the one who is responsible for your own actions. Well, at least under the common law you are, but we don't want to be responsible, now do we, Bob? Well, hang on here, boys and girls. I've got to give you a reminder that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. Now that's eight schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are talking about limited liability. Limited liability is insurance. It's the insurance industry that's so concerned about the state of traffic on our roads. It's the insurance company that wants you to buckle your seatbelt. And they go to the legislature and they get all of these 2,000 laws enacted. And these laws, rules, and regulations are designed to protect the claims window of the insurance industry. It has nothing to do with your health, safety, and welfare. It has to do with profits. That's the primary motive. Now, if as a result it saves somebody's life or it keeps somebody from cutting their fingers, then that's a collateral side effect, but that's not the reason that we're doing this. So let's all of us wake up and smell the coffee here and recognize that the motivating cause and effect relationship that is causing us to complain about the nanny state, to complain about government's intrusion into our private lives. There was a story came out the other day that the government is leaning on the food industry to take salt out of the manufactured food or to reduce it somewhat. And on the McLaughlin group, they were talking, and this woman who works for Newsweek magazine, Eleanor Clift is her name. And everybody was complaining on the panel about the nanny state dictating, you know, about their diet and about what they're going to eat. And Eleanor Clift said, well, the state needs to do that. It's a good law. The state needs to take that salt out. People are eating twice as much salt as they need, and that salt is contributing to high blood pressure and obesity and all kinds of bad things. And then she went on to complete her thought, in which most of the time her head is just a total blank, but every once in a while she comes up with a good line. And this was one of her best lines. And she said, now that the government has to pay for all of these health care costs, it's simply in the government's interest to make sure that there aren't any health care expenses. You know, I couldn't have said it any better, Eleanor. You're exactly right. And the same thing applies to the insurance company. You know, once the insurance company is responsible for your rehabilitation and your health, it makes all the sense in the world for the insurance company to go to the legislature seeking a seatbelt law. It just doesn't make any sense for those of us that want liberty and freedom of choice to want a seatbelt law. It is probably true that we ought not to eat too much salt. Actually, it's a no-brainer. If the government required the food industry to take half the salt out, and let's say that you're dissatisfied with the salt and you're eating at McDonald's and you haven't got enough salt, they've got a salt shaker right there on the table. You can put in all the salt you want. That way the people that don't want the salt in their food don't have to put any salt in, and they can have saltless food. And you who do want to put salt in, the salt shaker's right there on the table. It satisfies everybody. That's a win-win. Can't miss. But her comment that the government's responsible, that's exactly right. People who are not responsible for their actions then have to have a guardian to decide for them what's good for them. That's why we have parents for children, Social Security for people that can't take care of themselves. Now the law merchant has crept in upon us and taken our inalienable rights from us, subjecting us to an alien jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution, foreign to our Bill of Rights. Unfortunately, most citizens have voluntarily accepted this system of police state tyranny. Earlier in our history, we had a Constitution, we had law, we had order, we had freedom of action, and we had a lifestyle that was somewhat different from what we see in our society today. As an example, let's look at the traffic code to illustrate how we have enveloped ourselves in a Polish or Russian or Chinese-style police state tyranny in the name of law and order. Let's begin with the time when there were no traffic laws. There was traffic or movement on the roads, though. There was traffic on the trails or highways that preceded our traffic codes. So whether we were on foot, in wagons or horseback, carriage or stagecoach, there was traffic. In all of human history and in all of human endeavor, there are bound to be mishaps. When our common law was in force, when it was in use, the problem with affixing fault without any statutory law was difficult because there was no law against speeding. There were no stop signs. There were no pedestrian crosswalks. So when a loss occurred, a long common law litigation was necessary in order to determine liability and then to assess damages to the offending party to pay to the injured party. Now, with the advent of the horseless carriage, we began to see the proliferation of traffic laws and regulations. And as regulation increased, the average person then shifted his status at law. He shifted it to equity by entering into a quasi-contract through the use of the driver's license. And through the use of licenses and permits, the age-old rivalry of the equity courts and the common law courts took a decided turn to equity by statute. And the death of the common law began. Now, 80 or 90 years later, we find the common law in use only in major crimes, and the grand jury, for all practical purposes, has been abolished. If our Constitution is based upon the common law, and the grand jury is a fixed right pursuant to the Bill of Rights, well, how can government then arbitrarily eliminate? How did our government eliminate our grand juries? Well, it was done over time, and it was done by educating the public to accept equity in place of law. Now, where rights secured by the Constitution are involved, there can be no rulemaking or legislation which would abrogate them. That comes from Miranda versus Arizona, cited at 384 U.S. 436, and I'm on page 491. Listen to that again. Where rights secured by the Constitution are involved, there can be no rulemaking or legislation which would abrogate them. Now, oftentimes people, when they come into school, they will describe an event that transpired in the traffic court. And then they will say that traffic court did not follow the Miranda rule. They did not follow due process, equal protection, and search warrants and testimony and so on and so forth. And I then remind them, sir, wake up and smell the coffee here. There are no rights secured in the traffic court because there's nothing constitutional or unconstitutional going on in there. The traffic court is a contract court, and it deals with people with driver's licenses and registrations. It deals with people who are wards of the state, who are not responsible for their actions. How then can any state abrogate the entire common law by statute? Well, simply by coercing everyone to waive their common law rights under the Constitution by getting them to volunteer into equity jurisdiction through the use of contracts. The state simply licenses everybody, inducing them to accept a privilege in place of their right to travel. See, boys and girls, travel is a right. The state comes in and says, well, we're going to regulate your right to travel by automobile. Well, the automobile is the usual and ordinary conveyance of the day. But as a matter of law, it's the horse and buggy that is the usual and ordinary conveyance of the day. And this was tested in McKenzie versus New York in 1914, where the Supreme Court said, if the automobile should replace the horse and carriage as the usual and ordinary conveyance of the day, we would have a much different case before us. 6 years later, in 1920, the automobile had replaced the horse and carriage. But we never changed the law. And to this day, the politicians are regulating the unusual and extraordinary use of the highways by way of licensing. And you'll notice that you don't need a license to drive your horse and buggy up and down the highways. You need a license to drive your automobile up and down the highway. And that's because the highway is the right-of-way of the state. That's why it's called a right-of-way, which is being used by an extraordinary and unusual conveyance called a horseless carriage. Nobody ever changed the law. And then we're all born into the age and the era of the automobile, and when they tell you that driving an automobile is a privilege, they're not lying to you. It's true, as a matter of law. Operating your horse and your buggy is a right. Operating your Chevrolet is a privilege. And as old William Bendix used to say, what a revolting development this has turned out to be. Now, you know, no foreign power by force of arms or ideology has enslaved us. It is our own lack of understanding of our Constitution and of our common law heritage, our common law rights. It is our ignorance of, or it is our willingness to obey the Ten Commandments that has enslaved us to this new civil law jurisdiction. So, how has this come about? Well, you know, that's a pretty interesting story of and by itself. And I said, let's take a look at limited liability. There's a story that goes along with this limited liability. Now, I told you this story the other day, and I'm going to repeat it. Pay attention here. Let's go back in time to the turn of the century, when our common law was still in full force and effect. And let's visualize the scene. A wagon is loaded with mining supplies. It's traveling northbound from Boise to Idaho City. A Surrey, loaded with a family of six, is traveling south from Idaho City to Boise. When approaching each other, the vehicles collide head-on, killing three horses and injuring three children in Surrey. The driver of the wagon is killed. The property damage is hundreds of dollars. So now, who sues whom and for how much? Who was the party damaged? Was the driver of the wagon drunk? Was the driver of the Surrey speeding? Who was negligent? Is there a third-party insurance company involved in the action? Well, at the common law, this case would be very costly in terms of time and money to litigate. But both parties have rights, and the issue must be litigated in the courts, and a jury must decide the law as well as the facts in this case. Now, you'll notice that when you go into court today, the judge is very careful to instruct the jury that they're to take the law as he gives it to them. Well, of course the jury should take the law as he gives it to them. This is an equity court. This is chancery. This is an advisory jury. This is not a common law jury. And like as not, there's not 12 members of the jury. There's six. And they don't have to vote unanimously. They can just have a Democratic majority vote. That's equity. But boys and girls, equity is not the heritage of a common law freeman. It's not the heritage of an Englishman. That's the heritage of a slave. That's the heritage of the Slavs, the pagans around us. It's not our heritage. That didn't come from Moses. That didn't come from Mount Sinai. That doesn't come from our scripture. That's a foreign and alien ideology. We've adopted it. We've accepted it. We have implemented it. We have wallowed in it. We teach it. We practice it. But that isn't what we got from our founding fathers in 1787 with our Constitution. That isn't what we got in Article 1, Section 10 that says no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. Our founding fathers gave us the law of Moses. They gave us the law of our Creator. We have thrown that law away and adopted the law of the communists and adopted paper money, the Federal Reserve note, and the regulations and limited liability and irresponsibility. I don't deny it. That's what we've done. I just thought I'd bring it to your attention and ask you, is that really what you want? Because now you're crying out and you're saying, oh, my God, look at what this nanny state's doing to us. Well, that's right. That's exactly what God told you the nanny state was going to do to you back in 1 Samuel chapter 8 when you said, nevertheless, we will have a king, and gave him the finger, which prompted him to say, you'll cry out to me in that day because of this king that you've set over you. But in that day, when you cry out to me, I won't hear you. So I tell my students, here, you can cry out and pray to Jesus until hell freezes over. He ain't going to listen to you. As my old granny used to say, you made your bed, now go sleep in. All right, going on, then the automobile appeared on the scene. And the insurance company saw a way to make billions of dollars in premiums if they could keep the claims at a low level. As more cars appeared on the roads, accidents increased, and losses to insurance companies increased. So someone somewhere in the insurance business said, you know, we're having a lot of claims on these automobiles, so how can we cut costs and increase profits? One of the biggest problems was that of determining liability in accidents. As there were no rules of the road and only common sense prevailed, without written rules and regulations, it was difficult to affix responsibility. For example, was anyone speeding? Well, there weren't any speed laws. Was anybody drinking or drunk? There weren't any laws against driving drunk. Who crossed the center line? There weren't any center lines to cross. Any driver could drive on whatever side of the road he wanted to. Did the drivers have insurance? There weren't any laws compelling anybody to have insurance. Were the drivers licensed? There weren't any licensing laws. So to begin with, we see the alleged need for traffic laws. Who really needed these traffic laws? Well, the courts and the insurance companies needed them, and in particular, the insurance companies. The insurance companies needed traffic laws for economic reasons, and the courts needed them to expedite cases and litigation. So whether the traveling public needs traffic laws for their health, safety, or protection was not, is not, nor would it ever be the prime motivating factor in the passing of any traffic law for any cause or reason. Mercantile interests proposed these new laws through various governmental agencies and lobbyists, and led the legislature was duped into believing that it was in the best interest of the general welfare of the citizen. And the desires of private interests became the statutory law. So if you want to know why you're driving on the right side of the road here in America, and on the left side of the road over in England, it's the insurance companies that decided. You didn't have anything to do about it. None of you people ever went in there and testified before the committees and said, my God, we got to have a line down the middle of the road and a stop sign over here and traffic lights and licensing and insurance. And you people didn't decide that. That was decided for you. Now the question arises, well, who were these people that decided this for you? Well, it was the insurance industry. Now, for the sake of our discussion, let's go into the boardroom of a fictitious insurance company called Rip-Em-Off Incorporated and listen as they discuss the Surrey Wagon accident. The chairman of the board, Maurice Profitsmuch, calls the meeting to order and announces that the purpose of this meeting is to discuss ways to increase profits and cut costs. The chair recognizes Albert Suckerman. Albert begins by suggesting that the company go all out to sell collision, public liability, and property damage insurance to everyone who owns a vehicle. He points out that just selling insurance to business highly limits sales, and if we expand this business to the general public, profits would be staggering. It'll increase sales and revenue, and therefore profits will rise. The question, gentlemen, is how can we convince the ordinary citizens to buy this kind of business insurance? Hey, the question here is how do we go out and sell this to the general public? You know, in 1900, the general public did not buy insurance. Business bought insurance. Shipping companies bought insurance. Limited liability is the rule of the law of the merchants. But common law freemen practice individual responsibility. They don't practice limited liability. So now the insurance companies came into the game and they said, hey, not only will it aid us in the administration of our business, but it will also increase our profits. Now can you see why we have compulsory insurance in automobiles and now compulsory insurance in healthcare? Hey, I'm about out of time. Let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. That's it. Time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.